Michael, have you come home? You've come to enjoy the Halloween special on So What's Your Story? But why are you so angry? You fear that KPFT is in trouble? No, Michael. Look around you. We are in our new home on Caroline. We will stay out of trouble if listeners donate during our current fall drive. They simply need to call 713-526-5738 or go to www.kpft.org and then to donations and then make their payment and be sure to scroll to What's Your Story as the program deserving their support. Make your pledge, Michael, and then die. 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 This is Hank Rubichek, producer of So What's Your Story, the only show in Houston devoted to storytelling. And that was my annual and very pitiful Dr. Loomis imitation, because Halloween's around the corner, and we are also in the midst of our fall fun drive. So, like Michael, you crazy kids, if you're able to do so, please pledge your donations to KPFT, Radio for Peace. 713-526-5738, jam KPFT, or go to kpft.org. You'll be able to find us, scroll to us, and we'll love you for life. Our award-winning broadcast celebrates the power of story by placing the spotlight on live storytellers who engage us with stirring stories in every genre. We love our new time slot, too. Wednesdays at 6, so don't forget and make note of that. And it's also a team effort. It's easy when you have the best team on radio, and we do, in the likes of Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, and Larry Thompson. I don't have any tricks for you tonight, but I do have a few treats, starting with the classic, The Tell-Tale Heart, written in 1843 by the merciless master of mayhem, Edgar Allan Poe. Narrated by James Mason in this version, it's a popular story for radio, with a few snaps, crackle, and pop, as you'll hear in this version. It's the perfect medium for a character proclaiming his sanity as he murders a little old man in The Tell-Tale Heart.
Precisely, I can tell the story to you. Listen. It starts with the old man. An old man in an old house. A good man, I suppose. He had never harmed me. I didn't want his gold, if gold there was. Then what was it? I think it was his eye. Yes, that eye. The eye. That. His eye staring. Milky white film. The eye. Everywhere. Everywhere in everything. Of course, I had to get rid of the eye. So I waited. Watched. Waited. I was never so kind to the old man. I looked after him each minute, each second. And I waited. But night after night, in the hour of the slowest clock, I opened the old man's door. The eye was always closed. For 7 days I waited. You think me mad? What madman would wait, could wait so patiently, so long? In the old house. With the old man and the eye that... And on the eighth night, I knew. Tonight. Still, I waited. While time slowed. Stopped. Ebbed out. A watch's hand moved more quickly than mine. Then... What? No! For an hour, I did not move a muscle. I could feel the earth turn. The eye. Hear the spider spinning. In the house, the grinding crumble of decay. Then, something else. Dull and muffled, yet... Of course... It was the beating of the old man's heart. He knew. So strong for such an old man. Louder then. And still louder. For all the world to hear, I know. I had to stop it.
A scream. We're obliged to investigate.
A scream? My own gentleman. A childish dream. But come in, please. You'll want to look through the house.
That is our duty. Where's the old man?
Gone to the city.
You're up very early this morning.
The dream I spoke of, it awakened me.
When did he leave?
The old man? Yesterday.
How long will he be away?
2 weeks. Perhaps longer.
Nothing out of place here.
There is his bed. Here his cupboard. All in order.
Quite in order.
All quite in order.
Yes, nothing amiss. You understand that when a complaint is made, we have no choice.
Stay, please. Such a wretched hour. I was making tea. A hot drink will break the chill. Surely it would surprise good people how much evil the night conceals from their eyes. But not yours, to be sure. What did you say, sir? Yes, yes, of course, the hot water. It would do no harm to the bare boards. I'm a little less tidy with the old man away. Then I heard it. It might have been a hand, a clock. But no, louder, and still louder. They must hear it. Yet they sit and talk, they must. Of course they do. They know, they do. They're torturing me, watching me, letting it beat so that I... Stop it! Stop it, you devils! Yes, yes, I did it. It's there, under the floor. Oh, stop it! It is the beating of his hideous heart! True, I'm nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous.
But why will you say that I'm mad?
Well, I don't really want to sound like an English teacher. Well, maybe I do. I don't know. But there's a lot of symbolism in that story, obviously. It's always a fun one to talk about. But, you know, I always think about the watch, the one that serves as a distressing motif in this tale. It's mentioned four times in the story. And since the watch is both a physical and auditory reminder of time, it might signal the narrator's understanding that his time is running out. With each tick, the narrator remembers his own mortality. It's sort of like tuning into 90.1 FM. Oh, come on, you knew I would try to connect the two, right? And being reminded that it contains the eclectic programming that you've come to expect from Houston's community station. Reminder that we're all volunteers. But you don't tune in and say, yeah, what do you expect? They're volunteers. It's not a great show, but what do you want? These guys aren't paid. You expect excellence, and we'd like to think you get it. So unlike the old man, help us stay alive and ensure that we keep our new home, which is so cool here on Caroline, but we need funding to keep it going. And again, please give us a call at 713-526-5738, or if you prefer online, please go to www.kpft.org, then to donations, and scroll to So What's Your Story to punctuate the importance of the show, a place which gave 600 storytellers a chance to tell stories, a true example of community radio, and you're only going to find it here on KPFT, and we're awfully proud of that, awfully proud of that. You know, it's kind of the plausibility in ghost stories that kindles the feeling of terror. You know, the I could have, might have, should have. Here are a couple of quick-hitting examples by unknown authors that I think will make the point. This first one is entitled The Girl Who Stood on a Grave. Some boys and girls were at a party one night. There was a graveyard down the street, and they were talking about how scary it was. Don't ever stand on a grave after dark, one of the boys said. The person inside will grab you. He'll pull you under. Well, that's not true, one of the girls said. It's just a superstition. Well, you know what? I'll give you a dollar if you stand on a grave, said the boy. A grave doesn't scare me, said the girl. I'll do it right now. Well, the boy handed her his knife. Stick this knife in one of the graves, he said, and then we'll know you were there. The graveyard was filled with shadows, and it was quiet as death. There's nothing to be scared of, the girl told herself. But she was scared anyway. She picked out a grave and stood on it. And then quickly, she bent over and plunged the knife into the soil. And she started to leave. But she couldn't get away. Something was holding her back. She tried a second time to leave, but she couldn't move. She was filled with terror. Something has got me, she screamed, and she fell to the ground. When she didn't come back, the others went to look for her. They found her body sprawled across the grave. Without realizing it, she had plunged the knife through her skirt and had pinned it to the ground. It was only the knife that held her. She died of fright. Well, for those of you who've been around a while, you know that I pull that little toy out every year. I love it. So humor me. The next story is called Room for One More. A man named Joseph Blackwell came to Philadelphia on a business trip. He stayed with friends to the big house they owned outside the city. That night, they had a good time visiting. But when Blackwell went to bed, he tossed and turned and couldn't sleep. Sometime during the night, he heard a car turn into the driveway. He went to the window to see who it was. In the moonlight, he saw a long black hearse filled with people The driver of the hearse looked up to him. When Blackwell saw his hideous face, he shuddered, but the driver called to him, "There is room for one more." And then he waited for a minute or two and drove off. In the morning, Blackwell told his friends what had happened. "You were dreaming," they said. "I must have been, but it didn't seem like a dream." After breakfast, he went into Philadelphia. He spent the day high above the city in one of the new office buildings there. Late in the afternoon, he was waiting for an elevator to take him back down the street. But when it arrived, it was very crowded. One of the passengers looked out and called to him. "Hey, wait, there's room for one more," he said. And he looked and it was the driver of that same hearse. No, thank you," said Blackwell. "I'll get the next one." The doors closed and the elevator started down. There was shrieking and screaming and then the sound of a crash. The elevator had fallen to the bottom of the shaft and everyone aboard was killed. The plausibility of that second story. You know, for those of you who've been here a while, you probably know the legend of the old spaghetti warehouse. It was a pharmaceutical warehouse. And the story begins when a young pharmacist accidentally fell into the open elevator shaft, falling several feet to his death. His wife, traumatized by grief, died about a year later. It is said that these grief-stricken lost souls, especially the pharmacist's wife, haunt the restaurant. You know, Halloween haunts are all around Houston, and Houston, of course, has no shortage of haunts. And all of these haunts have great stories associated with them. Like the Rice Hotel, it's where John F. Kennedy spent his last night before being assassinated in November of 1963. Cold spots, rattling doors and beds, orbs of light, and a presence are frequently felt in JFK's room. Ghost dancers appear in the ballroom before it was renovated into the Rice Lofts. Now, the lofts are said to be haunted by spirits who dance on the rooftop. Glenwood Cemetery on Washington. I love this place because it's such a peaceful place really to walk through, and I live nearby. It's the final resting place of many influential Houstonians, including Howard Hughes. The manicured tree-shaded lawns appear serene, but appearances can be deceiving. Turns out that the unsolved murder of the owner of the cemetery inspires his spirit to roam aimlessly on the grounds. Named after the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, its hospital, now the Elder Street Lofts, is another famous location explored by paranormal investigators. It was erected in 1924 atop what was once a Confederate cemetery, and before that, a burial site for plague victims. Screams and howls have been heard throughout the building, and shadowy figures have been caught on film. Downtown wine and dive bar, La Carafe, is believed to be the oldest bar in Houston. Built in 1866, the building is most notably haunted by a former bartender named Carl. Employees have reported hearing footsteps, glass breaking, the sound of heavy objects moving around the vacant second floor, and cold spots in the restroom. Carl has been spotted standing in the second floor window after closing time. I remember I was there once and wanted to go to the restroom, needed to go upstairs where Carl was allegedly residing. I gotta tell you, I got halfway up the stairs and I didn't see anything, but I sure as hell felt something. It was strong enough where I backtracked and went downstairs. I just imagined getting up there and just kind of peeing in my pants before I got to the restroom. It was pretty scary, very scary. Places like the Brewery, Alley Theater, Battleship Texas, and Hotel Galvez add to a pretty impressive list of other haunting locations, not really for the faint of heart. My wife and I visited Gettysburg a few years ago. That night, my paranormal skeptic wife looked over to me with a blank stare and in a sort of lower than normal monotonous voice, almost expressionless, she says, "Look at this." She shows me a photo of a woman, transparent, colorless, looking in the front window of the Jenny Waite House, considered one of the most haunted places in the nation. And we had that photo verified, and it was a ghost. In fact, one expert saw two. You can see it for yourself. We have it on the Facebook page. It's always a fun thing to see. And Gettysburg is considered one of the most haunted places in the nation. And with thousands of soldiers lying dead and their souls seeking revenge and fear and aimlessly gathered around, it's been a bunch of stories associated with it. And those stories are told by seemingly normal people to reinforce it. I've got a few of those stories, and I thought you might enjoy them.
Parking lot. But on the northern end, a view just west and parallel with Steinwehr Avenue, runs one of the many small streams that are found in and around the town of Gettysburg. Most of it is covered by a parking lot, but on the northern end, a view of the stream is offered. Like many of the other streams, it runs slow and sluggish most of the time, but by design of nature or man, it is there to carry off water from the heavy rainfall that can occur in this area. During the battle, these slow stream beds were a perfect place for a soldier to seek refuge from shot and shell, and the wounded would naturally crawl to them to wash their wounds in the cool water. One such stream, Plum Run, in the Devil's Den area, actually ran red with blood and is now forever more known as Bloody Run. But our little stream had its own story to tell on the night of July 4th, 1863, when there was a horrendous rainstorm in this area. As the water rose, it washed the dead and wounded down with the current until they piled up against the culvert that passes under Baltimore Street. The next morning, passers-by were greeted by a gruesome sight. But then again, there were no shortage of gruesome sights that summer of 1863 in Gettysburg.
It was a beautiful fall evening. Leaves were crunching underfoot, and the trees were casting long shadows as evening approached. Joyce and her young daughter Dawn were enjoying a pleasant walk on the battlefield and were now in the area between Devil's Den and the Triangular Field. They paused along a stone wall and were enjoying the view when Dawn suddenly said, "Mommy, people are sleeping." "Yes," her mother said, "some people do go to bed early." "No, Mommy, people are sleeping." "What do you mean?" Joyce replied. "Mommy, I see people sleeping, here on the ground." She said it like it was something very unnatural. Like, "Mommy, don't you understand? You see them too, don't you?" It was all Joyce could do to contain the fear she felt. "Yes," Joyce said in the calmest voice she could muster, "but now it's time to go." You know, children and animals sometimes see and hear things we as adults don't understand. And there is that old saying that out of the mouths of babes come pearls.
I have a friend who lives in Gettysburg. When I visit him, we often go to the battlefield. We check out the new statues or visit some of my favorite spots. One of those is Little Round Top. I like the monument for the 44th New York soldiers. It's like a castle. The 44th New York monument is the largest regimental marker on the battlefield. It is 44 feet high. One evening, we drove over to Little Round Top and got out of the car. I headed for the monument while Frank did his thing. This was on September 30th. I remember because that's my birthday. The day had been mild and we went over to watch the sunset. Walking to the monument, I noticed that someone was already on the tower. It looked like he was a reenactor. He was dressed in blue and had a strange appearance, almost like a shadow, but in color. I glanced up at him as I stepped inside and I noticed that he was looking down at me. I started up the narrow stairs. I wanted to ask the soldier if he was with the reenactors. I admit that the battlefield gives me the creeps because of all the men who had died there. As I climbed the stairs, I had the oddest sensation. And when I reached the top, I looked for the man, but no one was there. and there was no place to hide, and I hadn't passed him on the stairs, and there was only one way up or down. I could feel the goosebumps on my arm. I calmly called for Frank. He looked at me strangely, but didn't say a word. Someday he will read this story and probably laugh his head off. During the battle, Little Round Top was used as a lookout position by Union troops. It commanded a perfect view of the entire battlefield. Could the soldier Linda saw be the spirit of a lookout killed in the battle, eternally searching for the enemy that is long gone?
I'm a tour guide for Haunted Gettysburg. As we were doing a tour one night, we were set to go with a K2 meter and a voice recorder. We began our tour and hoping for some paranormal activity. My husband and son were along to help with everyone. And then before I knew it, I heard my son scream. As a mother, my heart raced and I turned around and he was on his knees with his back arched. He said, "Mom, I feel like I was stabbed." I asked him, "Can you continue with the tour?" He told me, "Yes, Mom, don't worry." We walked along a wood line. I smelled medicinal smells, heard horses running. Then to my amazement, my son screams again. I ran to him. He told me he had been stabbed again. I pulled up his shirt and he had a scratch and he was bleeding. I took him to the truck to be safe. I went back to my group. I took a picture at the wood line and caught an apparition of a Confederate soldier with a very stern look on his face. We felt that we had had a very productive night. The question is, do the soldiers still roam the battlefields of Gettysburg? My answer is, I have proof that they do.
You know, I think these are very cool stories, fueled by history. And one of the things that I learned from stories about history, we all do, is that, you know, there's a very fine line between fiction and nonfiction. I'm not sure if I would characterize that as a thin line, but I don't know. The old adage that life is stranger than fiction sometimes, I think, really comes to fruition through some of these stories. Let me tell you where the scariest place is in the world. And that is wherever you are when you're trying to tune into KPFT and hear, that's right, silence, because there's a serious lack of funding, making it impossible to bring you the programming you've come to expect. Remember, KPFT is Houston's community station. It's a Pacifica affiliate, and that means we are listener-sponsored, plain and simple. Our So What's Your Story team knows that donating isn't always possible for many of you. Times are tough. That's okay. Better times ahead will make that more likely. So I'm reaching out to those of you who can comfortably donate. And if you are in that group, please go to kpft.org or give us a call at 713-526-5738 and tell the friendly volunteers that So What's Your Story encouraged your call. You know, a reminder, we're all volunteers, like I was mentioning earlier. We do this for love, and we love you for tuning in. But again, we do need your help. 713-526-7. You know, I say this number so many times that I'm virtually forgetting it. 713-526-5738. Jam, KPFT. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm hoping that you're enjoying some of these Halloween-oriented stories. You know, we frequently get people calling in or texting me, asking me how or if I have any books in mind where people can start generating stories. Well, I talk about mine, of course, and Eric Hain has a great one of our hosts, called Camels Really Do Spit. But one of the stories that orients characteristics on haunted stories in particular is written by one of the best storytellers in the country, Lauren Neamey. Pronounced Neamey, but it's spelled N-I-E-M-I. And the book is called What Haunts Us by Moonfire Publishing. It's a terrific book about what makes great ghost stories. But whether you want to learn to tell ghost stories, personal narratives, or folk tales, the Houston Storytellers Guild is the best place for you. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Just go to our website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org, and the link will be under events. It's there all the time. Same link, same month. Same circus, different clowns. And I'm looking forward to seeing you. And one of our very special events is coming up in just a few days, October 22nd, Saturday. Got a date? Great place to go. At Marmion Park, 15th and Heights Boulevard. The event is called Skyline Screamers, so bring a blankie so you can hide underneath. Actually, it's very child-friendly. It's also free. It's a great date night, and you're going to meet some of the nicest people in town. Beautiful part of town right under the gazebo, 15th and Heights Boulevard. The Guild's website, again, has all the essential information. We kick it off at 7 o'clock. It goes for about an hour and a half. And again, it's very friendly to children and just great, great storytellers. Also, if you want to take your skills to the next level, you can do it by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association as well as the National Storytelling Network. And by the way, if you've got any ideas of show themes or guests that you'd recommend, why don't you drop us a line on our Facebook page or shoot us an email at SWYS. Of course, that is an acronym for So What's Your Story? At kpft.org, or text me at 832-277-1581. Hank, 832-277-1581. Label it a show idea or SWYS. Do that if you're texting or if you're emailing. I promise we're going to get back to you. One thing that I learned is that a ghost story is very unique because it needs the element of surprise for both listener and teller. It also needs an opening that would prompt someone to say, I got to hear this. Sort of like a movie that you hadn't planned to watch, but you catch the beginning and then you say, you know what? Now I'm just mesmerized. I got to watch it. Here are a few examples of what I mean. These are short openings to ghost stories, but here's the thing that I think is very cool. The stories are not crafted. It's just the opening. Sort of like, I got a great opening, and now I'm going to craft a story that's based on it. But here's one that's very unique. This one is written by Frederick Brown. It was published in 1948. It's a complete story, and it consists of two sentences. It reads, "The last man on earth sat alone in a room, and then there was a knock on the door." Nick Geary's creative writing students at the Berklee Center of the Arts came up with some spooky sentences. These are sentences without full stories that follow, but great sentences. Here's one by Cheyenne Smith. Whatever it was staring back at him from the bathroom mirror, he was certain it was something inhuman. With shaking hands, he reached for the door, but the knob wouldn't turn. The sound of footsteps echoed in the otherwise empty school hallway. So Lillian turned around, only to find herself staring back. She stretched out her mouth good and wide and swallowed herself whole. Here's one that I think is, wow, very unique, extremely interesting. I took a late shower last night, and when I got out, I saw my reflection in the mirror, smiling at me, except I wasn't smiling. I thought that was very, very cool. Incredibly creative. Texas haunts are sometimes told by the best storytellers around. I shared a few the other just a little while ago, but those are not Texas stories per se. Those are Houston friendly or not so friendly, taking place at places where stories apparently occurred. But one of the best storytellers in Texas of all time is the late Jerry Young, whose festivals really were legendary. His performances at these Texas festivals were incredible. But it's his ghost stories that you don't want to do without this time of year. Prom Night is one of his best. Hope you enjoy it.
The white jackets of the Renner tuxedo lay sprawled across the back seat of Jeb Ryder's 56 blue and white Chevrolet Impala. Elvis Presley sang Love Me Tender from the radio, with collars open and ties undone. Jeb and Josh Rainier sang backup at full volume. A light rain spattered the windshield as Jeb drove home to Gatlin, Texas. Riding shotgun, Josh rolled down the window, stuck his torso outside, and howled at the rain. The two friends knew that this was the best night of their whole lives. They had just come from the best prom in the history of Gatlin, Texas. They knew their dates were the prettiest girls at the dance, and in 3 days they would graduate. Driving home was like cooling down after football practice. The light rain became a steady downpour as the Impala approached that long sweeping curve into Hickory Creek Bridge. Jeb turned the windshield wipers on full speed and he lit up on the gas pedal. Impala's headlights glared in the sheeting rain. Jeb and Josh stopped singing as they peered through the sweep of the windshield wipers. Then as the Impala approached Hickory Creek Bridge, the glare of the headlights framed a frail blonde girl dressed in off-the-shoulder blue formal, standing right at the edge of the road next to the bridge. She waved her hand like she wanted to ride. Jeb gripped the steering wheel as he braked to a stop. The girl's sudden appearance startled the boys, and it took them a few minutes to catch their wits. Through the sweep of the windshield wipers, Jeb and Josh saw that the girl was about their ages. Her hair streamed down around her shoulders, and her blue dress was soaked like she'd been standing in the rain a long time. She appeared to be dressed like she had been to the prom, but the boys thought the girl's blue formal dress looked like one that the girl's mother might have worn when she went to the prom. A single white gardenia corsage was pinned to the dress. Well, maybe she had been to the prom, but the boys didn't remember seeing her there. Jeb rolled down his window and called the girl, "Hurry up, get in." Josh reached over the back seat and opened the back door. But the girl didn't move. She just stood there, her shoulders hunched against the rain. Jeb and Josh jumped from the Impala and hustled the girl into the back seat. With the dome light on, they got a better look at her. Mud stained her dress, and there were scratches and bruises on her face, on her neck. Jeb and Josh saw her shivering, and they put their tuxedo jackets around her. "Are you all right? How'd you get here?" Jeb asked. "I want to go home," the girl said in a colorless, flat voice. The girl's voice was so soft that the boys weren't sure she'd said anything. "Were you at the prom?" asked Josh. "Where's your date?" "I want to go home," the girl said again. "How did you get those cuts and bruises on your face?" Jeb asked her. The girl didn't say anything. She just sat, looked straight ahead. She didn't seem to see Josh or Jeb either one. Josh tried one more time. "What's your name? I'm Josh and this is Jeb." "I want to go home," the girl whispered once again. Jeb and Josh looked at each other, puzzled. "Well, sure, we'll take you home. Where do you live?" Jeb asked her. 613 Poplar Street," she said. Now, Gatlin, Texas is not a big town, but the boys weren't sure they knew where Poplar Street was. By the time the Impala passed Forney's service station and hamburger shack on the edge of town, the rain had stopped. Josh turned to look at the girl in the back seat, and She hadn't moved. Her eyes stared straight ahead without blinking. "You okay?" Josh asked softly. "I want to go home," the girl whispered in the same strange, flat voice. Josh turned back to the front, and he and Jeb looked at each other, and they shrugged their shoulders. Impala cruised along Main Street. The stores were dark and closed. The street lamps cast white shadows on the wet, oily asphalt. The single stoplight at the intersection of Main and Broadway flashed red in all four directions. Jeb slowed the car and stopped at the red light, then slowly accelerated again. They drove in silence for two or three blocks. It was like the rain had washed away all the noises. Jeb asked, "Where is Poplar Street?" Josh turned towards the back seat for the girl's answer. "Well, she's not here," he yelped. "What?" said Jeb, and he braked the Impala to a stop. "She's not here," Josh repeated. Jeb turned in his seat. "Where'd she go?" he asked. "I didn't hear her get out of the car." "Well, maybe she got out when we stopped at the stoplight." "Can't be," said Jeb. "We would have heard the car door shut." Jeb whipped the car around in the middle of the street. They patrolled up and down Main Street, and they drove up and down Broadway. They searched for the girl back and forth, and there's no signs of her. It was as if she never existed. "Well, now what'll we do?" Josh asked. "I don't know," said Jeb. "Maybe we should find her parents and tell them." "What, do you know where Poplar Street is?" Jeb said, I think it's over on the east side of town." Jeb turned the car and headed into the oldest part of Gatlin. The houses were run down and unpainted, sagging roofs and porches. Yards were cluttered with trash and junk cars rusted in the streets. Even with spring coming on, the trees were lifeless. Instead of making things fresh, the rain only made the neighborhood black and water-soaked. The boys drove through the streets, and in the glare of the headlights, they tried to read the street signs. Josh suddenly called, "There it is, Poplar Street." Then he called off the numbers as Jeb eased the car along the street. 400, 500, 601, 607, 611, there it is, 613. Jeb stopped the car in front of an old two-story house. Looked like all the other houses on the block, run down and unpainted. A rusty iron fence enclosed a yard filled with junk and winter brown zinnias. The boys got out of the car. Rusty hinges croaked loudly as they opened the iron gate. They looked at each other for courage before they walked up the sidewalk to the front door of the dark house. Jeb knocked on the door, and no one came. "Well, maybe you ought to knock on the glass," suggested Josh. Jeb pulled open the screen door and rapped on the glass. A light came on in the back of the house. A moment later, the window and the door lighted up as a light was turned on. The shade covering the window fluttered, and one eye peered out at the boys. A woman's voice said, "What do you boys want at this time of night?" Josh said, "I'm Josh Rainier, and this is Jeb Ryder. We just gave a ride to a girl, and she said she lived here." The window shade fluttered again, and the eye disappeared. The boys heard a skeleton key rattling in the lock, and the door opened halfway, like the person behind it wasn't sure she should open it any farther. The lady framed in the half-open door had gray, wiry hair and gray eyes. A limp, worn, once pink chenille bathrobe covered her nightgown. "What did you say?" There was a bit of alarm in the woman's voice. "We found this girl standing beside the road near Hickory Creek Bridge," explained Jeb. "The rain was pouring down, and we got her in the car. She was shivering all over, and we put our jackets around her to warm her up." Josh added, "All she said was, I want to go home, and she gave us this address." "But when we got to town, she wasn't in the car," explained Jeb. "We drove around looking for her, but we didn't find her. We don't know what happened to her." The woman listened carefully. Then she pulled the door open and pushed the screen door open. "Come in," she said. Once the boys were seated in an old gray sofa, the woman said, "This girl, you found her standing beside Hickory Creek Bridge? Is that right?" "Yes, ma'am," said Jeb. "And she had blonde hair, and she wore an off-the-shoulder blue formal with a white gardenia corsage." The boys looked at each other amazed. "But yes, ma'am," said Jeb. "And her face had cuts and bruises on it," the woman continued. "Yes," Josh said. How did you know?" "The girl's name is Earlene," the woman said. "She was my daughter. 20 years ago, she went to the prom. On the way home, it was raining a downpour. The Jake's car skidded off the road at Hickory Creek Bridge. I was told her last words were, 'I want to go home.'"
Ah, Jerry. Jerry Young, as the late Jerry Young, was really and truly one of the great storytellers of all time. And that's the truth. No hyperbole. His concerts were quite remarkable. What you heard in the back is coughing. I was coughing. You know why? Because not only are we celebrating Halloween, we are celebrating ragweed season, right? And those of you who have allergies know what I am talking about. And we're also celebrating candy season, right? You love candy? You know, I love those Russell Stovers, you know, the ones that are shaped like a pumpkin. And in a few weeks, they'll be shaped like a Santa Claus. And then about a month after that, they'll be shaped like hearts, sort of like Peeps, right? We parallel the season. But I don't think they're good for you. They're not good for you, folks. Don't buy them. Instead, save your pennies and give them to us, KPFT. Give us a call, 713-526-5738. You know, so What's Your Story has been around 14 years, and I am so proud of this show. It's become such an institution here in Houston. It started off 2008. I was a guest on an open journal on a Friday afternoon, and it was an open show. Literally, it was about a number of things. I was in the midst of my career as a communication professor at UHD. I retired just a few years ago, and I was talking about human expression and how there is no substitute for human expression, no way, and that storytelling is one way to take people on journeys and take them back to the present safely, and a number of other things. So the following day, I get a call from our station manager asking me if I wanted to host a show. I told him I didn't know. I really hadn't thought about it. And he told me that they had a spot for an open journal host. And I said, why not? I'll give it a try. And he told me that I could do a show about virtually anything I wanted. I told him I wanted to do a program on storytelling. He laughed a little bit and said, well, you know, it's a good idea, but I'm not sure it'll go over well. I pointed out that Your American Life does well, but I wanted to make it more local. He said, give it a shot. Well, we did. We brought storytellers in, live storytellers every month. And that was a hard thing to do, because I had to really find people who wanted to tell stories. Turned out everybody wants to tell their story. I got calls like you would not believe. Hank, you know what? This is great, but we want it more often. We want it every week. Well, we got it every week. At first, it was at 6 a.m. that was hard. I had to bribe people with donuts and coffee. But eventually, we went every week. We moved from one time slot to another, eventually moving into the one we have right now, 6 o'clock on Wednesdays, a great time slot. But you know what? People love stories. We've had storytellers on, and this is no exaggeration, from the ages of 10 to 100, literally. And they've told stories from everything from their fathers to losing children. There was one mother years ago who told a story about her daughter being murdered in a street in Detroit, my jaw opened because I didn't know what her story would be about. We have some of the funniest stories. We have stories that were so sad, trajectories about every conceivable part of our life. I'm telling you, we really are genuinely a Houston institution. And stories are all around us. All of us know that. They validate who we are. You know, when I think about Halloween, for example, I think about a time when I was 8 years old. I was sick. It was raining outside. It was cold. I was living in, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I couldn't go trick-or-treating, and I was so, so sad. When you're 8 years old, Halloween is everything. My grandfather, who was the kindest man God ever created, and a man of very few words, turns out he snuck around the front of the house, rang the bell. And my mother answered the door, and it was my grandfather, of course, trying to hide his identity. He had on one of those yellow raincoats, you know, the kind we used to wear as kids, the rubbery kind of yellow raincoats. They looked ridiculous. He had that on along with a very goofy Lone Ranger mask and a bag, and he was soaked. And in his Eastern European accent, he says very softly, "Trick or treat," trying to get me to believe that he was a legitimate kid trick or treating. I loved him for it. I never told him that I knew who he was, ever. I never let anybody know until years later. I'm sure that he knows I caught on. That's obvious. But I thought about that. A little memory, right? No big deal. Just a few moments at the time I was 8 years old, sitting in a house, crying because nobody was trick-or-treating on that cold, damp night. Memories. That's what stories are. We're born a blank page, everyone. We're born a blank page, and every day of our lives gives us a chance to create another story, an episode, those moments frozen in time. And when we tell stories, it means that it's time to let those memories thaw. We just let them thaw, and we share them with others. Oh, yeah. Halloween. Have fun, everybody. Because when witches go riding and black cats are seen, the moon laughs and whispers, "'Tis near Halloween." Don't you dare move. Don't even think about leaving. Because the news is coming up next, followed by Living Art, another great show that you're only going to find on Houston's community station, KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home or turning in for the night, join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story and Treasure What You Hear. This is Hank Rubichek, along with Dr. Loomis, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean that you can't live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
If there's something weird and it don't look good, who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
I ain't afraid of no ghosts. I ain't afraid of no ghosts.